Hello, innovators, explorers, and entrepreneurs. Welcome to another episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. And in this podcast, I am interviewing Jesse Berger. Jesse is a serial founder, entrepreneur, movie maker, and a decentralization enthusiast. He has raised tens of millions for tech startups that he has built in the past and hundreds of millions for movies that he has produced. This episode has lots of learning from Jesse's experience of building a startup, producing movies, raising capital, and building a product that will decentralize the web. In my opinion, this is one of the most engaging conversations on decentralization funding for your startup or for your project and building a great startup. Nothing mentioned in this podcast should be taken as investment advice, and please do your own research. So with that out of the way, let's get into it. So Jesse, it's great to have you on the show. I'm so looking forward to talking with you because not only you work in Web3, you have got experience as an entrepreneur, you have raised funding, you have done all sorts of interesting things. So just to get started, can you please tell me a bit about your background and how you got into entrepreneurship and Web3?
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to be here with you. Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah, my background has been very much rooted in entrepreneurship my whole life. I've been focused on ways to be entrepreneurial, starting businesses, raising capital, pretty much my whole entire life, even dating back to when I was in my teenage years. I was really focused on building businesses and stuff like that since I was at a very young age. But the beginning of my adult entrepreneurship really was after I graduated film school, and I moved down to Los Angeles after completing school and got fully immersed into getting into the movie business. And the basis for that wasn't so much on starting a company, but it was becoming a movie producer. And that was an aspiration I'd had since I was very young. And what's very interesting, and I would only be able to know this looking back on my life, but the whole idea of making a movie as a producer is the exact same roadmap to building a company. You have an idea, which is your script.
Yes.
You need to go raise money. You need to bring people in to become involved with that, both in the case of using the analogy of a movie, being your actors, your director. You need to bring strong talent into the business. And then ultimately, once you create your product, which is your finished movie, you then need to take that to market and build community around it and getting people involved to see your movie. And that's the commerce side of it. And then you learn all the fundamentals around how you're running a waterfall or a P&L and trying to turn that into a profit, repay your investors, etc. So that whole path of becoming a producer really is what trained me to becoming an entrepreneur and led to the businesses that I ultimately began.
I love that comparison. And just like in movies, not every movie is a success. Just like in the startup world, not every startup is a success. But one thing is for certain, and that is that you learn a lot from whether you create a movie of your own or create a startup. So what about Routee that you're building currently? Can you tell me a bit about Routee, how you get started building it?
Absolutely. Again, very much roots back into my history in the movie industry. And I'll take you on a little bit of a roundabout way to get to Routee, but let me just first explain what Routee is as a company.
Yes, please.
So I think that will provide some really good context. So the overall mission of Routee, which is spelled R-O-U-T-I-E, the whole mission of this company is providing guest Wi-Fi and helping people get connected to the internet. And what we realized was there's a lot of people who just don't have internet access. And a lot of people think, well, of course I have internet access. I have a phone, I have a computer, especially if you live in any type of metropolitan area. But
yes,
everybody can attest to these times where you've had a phone and haven't had internet connectivity, or have had internet connectivity, but it's been really poor. So you like can't, you know, get on a Zoom call, or you can't get onto social media or something like this. And so there really is challenges. There's lots of pockets of lack of connectivity around the world. And especially even if you say you're from the US and you travel to a foreign country, sure, you have a phone, but you're still looking for Wi-Fi. because maybe the internet connection is poor, or maybe you have very limited amount of data when you're roaming, right? So connectivity is just such a fundamental part of our culture globally. And we realize that the places that have the internet should be more accessible. And so where are those places? We realize if you look, those places are a lot of hospitality businesses, hotels, restaurants, cafes, motels, even campsites and places like this have internet access. And the other thing that those businesses are obviously interested in is building a connection with their customers, getting more customers to come to those locations. So we really started focusing on, okay, what if we could put two and two together here, which is having internet connectivity become available for people and the businesses to be able to get one-to-one relationship with their customers by offering them internet access in exchange for an email address or some sort of identifying information so that they can communicate with their customers.
That's fantastic. I have so many questions, but we'll go into that about Rauti and about Wi-Fi and internet very soon. But before that, it's, you know, how you have raised funding multiple times and a lot of the audience of this podcast are founders. Do you have any advice for founders who are looking at raising funding? How did you do it, or what were your key lessons in doing that?
Yeah, I've raised funding numerous times. I've raised approximately, just as a founder, I've raised over $30 million across multiple companies. But as a film producer, I've raised hundreds of millions of dollars for the films that I've produced. So, and as I mentioned, each film is very much like a startup. And so I have a lot of experience with all the different processes that can help you get access to investors. And then once you're talking to an investor, what the investor wants to know and what kind of information you can communicate with the investor to get them feel comfortable with actually making that investment. And I would say the key things for me was always focusing on the exit. So it was almost like work your way backwards. I think most founders go into it saying, hey, this is what I'm going to use the money for. The investor really doesn't care about how you're going to use the money. They just want to hear how they're going to get the money back. So I really started focusing on, okay, let's work backwards from where you get your recoupment from and how we're going to build enough, whether it be equity value for an exit or revenue for return on investment for them to get their investment back. And I was always very interested in using Excel models and business plans to really clearly articulate that. And I think some of the best success that I've had communicating with investors has been using spreadsheets to walk them through high, medium, and low projections, and then really stress testing our revenue projections against reality, market realities of achieving them.
That's fantastic. So is the Radical Studios, what are some of the movies and things that people would know that you produced or that you're involved with?
Yeah, for sure. So Radical has had a really exciting history, and I'll tell a little story on how we built into becoming Radical Studios, because it actually started with a comic book publishing company called Radical Publishing, which ultimately became this much larger entity. But as far as just to answer your initial question on what movies we made, the first movie we made was a $160 million movie called Oblivion, starring Tom Cruise and Morgan Freeman. And we did that with Universal Pictures and a very talented director named Joseph Kaczynski, who most recently directed the Top Gun 2 movie. At the time that we got in business with Joe, he actually had not directed a film yet, a feature film yet. And during the time when we were developing Oblivion, he landed his first really big movie, which was Tron 2 with Disney.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit of good luck, I guess you could say, a little bit of intuition that this was a very talented filmmaker and he had a great idea. And then our secret sauce at Radical was creating this very unique presentation materials, this very specific art quality that we created a presentation, and ultimately using his recent interest in the movie industry, like a lot of people were really excited about the prospect of working with Joe as a director and this really beautiful art and great story. And that's ultimately how we set that project up. That was our first movie. So we shot that movie in 2012, it came out in 2013. And then right on the heels of that, we made a movie called Hercules that's starring Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, and did that with MGM and Paramount. And we shot that movie in 2013 and that came out in 2014. Our first two movies was $200 million. Movies have gone on to do just shy of $500 million in the box office. And across the entire slate of Radical Pictures, just shy of $1 billion in global revenue.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's very inspirational to hear, and how a presentation can have such a big impact on that. What lessons do you think you've learned from that that you can apply for Rowdy.io?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is where Rowdy came into the world. So in my background in the movie industry, I became very tuned into where the money comes from. Like I said, I always start from the end and work my way back. And so what you realize is that the money is all on the distribution side when you're talking about movies, obviously, because you're creating a product, you're distributing that product, you're getting audience to buy that product, whether it be seeing it in the theaters or buying it online or licensing it out to television and streamers. And then ultimately that revenue flows back. And what I realized is my frustrations, actually, as a filmmaker, as a studio executive and an executive running Radical, I became very frustrated watching how much money these products that we had labored over had made, and watching how little of that money actually made it back to the filmmakers and the creators. It was actually pretty shocking. You know, these movies, we can celebrate, hey, so many hundreds of millions of dollars worth of revenue, but when that cash never actually makes it back to the filmmaker, it's very defeating and quite frustrating. So it's like you had success, but if the money never arrived in your bank account, was it actually successful for you on an individual yes. basis? And so I became very really disillusioned maybe a bit in some of the economic structures of the entertainment industry. And I realized that there's a very severe issue that was brewing back. This was like 2017, 2018, where we were seeing the rise of the streamers. So it's Netflix, Hulu, Amazon. You're seeing these companies become very substantial. You're seeing yes. huge war chests to investing in content and a lot of customers coming in and becoming subscribers. And I just saw the writing on the wall that there was going to be a sea change with how money was going to be made in the industry, where you would see a de-emphasis on people going to the theater, and you'd see a shift in the licensing fees and in the value of those licensing fees and the television rights. And you would see an increase in emphasis on the streaming side of things. And what to make matters even worse, the way the streamers were doing business and are doing business is that they pay you to create a product for them. And because their revenue comes from subscribers rather than from actual customers buying the product offline or going to a theater, the whole entire economic model had changed. And what they're doing is just paying you a flat fee, and there's no back-end participation in the success of those movies or television shows. And so what that was going to do is take what I was seeing problems in the legacy business model and make it even worse for the content creators in this new streaming business model. And I basically called it exactly. I knew that was going to happen. Fast forward now 5-6 years later, and you know, we're seeing that materialize with the writer's strike and the actor's strike that all just occurred. And that led me to this focus on there needing to be an alternative way for people to distribute content that's not controlled by a Fortune 500 company. So mm-hmm. even YouTube, which is anyone can post on YouTube, you could say, but the economic model is governed by YouTube and ultimately Google.
Yeah.
And if you're a filmmaker, right now the holy grail for release and distribution is for your product to be on Netflix or bought by Amazon or something of this nature. But the number of films that are bought by just really talented content creators out there is very low. Why? Because those streamers are manufacturing their own content in-house. Why? Because they can pay a flat fee and they own it forever. So it's, and they can be very specific about the quality of the content, the people involved in the content, and they can just be laser focused on what they need for their platform, rather than going into the market and spending a lot of money trying to find good product, right? That's become more difficult for content creators. And so I just really got interested in how we could build a decentralized network that anybody could use to distribute their content. And so that led us to good timing around the blockchain world coming to fruition in a big way, more for the public around 2017, 2018. It's more about price speculation for Bitcoin reaching all-time highs, Ethereum reaching all-time highs at that time. But where I became interested was more around the blockchain technology, the immutable ledger, and this concept that if we could have a network that had integrated payments, where there was transparency on the revenue, so you could actually release content and you have a payment solution where people could pay for that content, and there would be complete transparency for the content creators to see how much money those pieces of content had made, and the use of smart contracts or a very clear waterfall that shows and delineates, you know, how much money came in gross. And then you could have a very transparent way of articulating how much money had been spent or repay or needing to repay your investors. And if the product had failed at that point, you could at least feel comfortable that the royalty statement is accurate. Whereas with the Hollywood world, you get a paper royalty statement and there's really no way to know if what you're looking at is 100% accurate, because there's just no supporting documentation for it. It's just like, hey, your movie lost money. Here's the statement that our accountants created. And you just have to accept that. So that led me down that path. We got involved with a community who was launching a decentralized network, which is called PKT.
Yep.
And that project went live. It's a proof of work mined coin. It was a fair mine. There's no company. There's no investors. And it was just a community, open source community project that launched in August 2019. And I've been a founding community member of that project there prior to its launch. And then that became just, it became a really successful, exciting project. And so that's what ultimately led to originally the company being called Packet Pal. So it was about selling devices that would help people participate in the Packet network. And we had a huge amount of success with that. That right out of launch, we started building a hardware product and a software solution. We made $1 million in revenue in our first year operating that business. And then we use the success of that initial business model to go out and raise capital to do what we're doing today, which is expanding that network into guest Wi-Fi and some of the other exciting initiatives within the organization.
Oh, that's fantastic. I would love to elaborate on something that you talked about, distribution. And that is such a commonly overlooked part of clubs of businesses that visionary founders often overlook, because in my point of view, what I've seen over the last 20 years of being in the whole startup world and business world, having two exits, worked, interviewed thousands of founders in over the last 20 years, and some even who have $1 billion plus in revenue and so on. And this is the common theme I have seen what successful startups do. First is that the first part of the journey, you need the vision, you need the ability to storytell, just like you did. You had the vision, the storytelling, the pitch deck, to convey your mission. And that leads to the second part, is enrolling talent to help you build that project, movie, startup, whatever product it might be, as well as work in that company and is the team. And the quality of the team often dictates the quality of the output and the product. And then the last but the most important part is distribution. Things that Amazon have done really well with, or TikTok, or any one of these have done really well, is everyone has access to it anywhere in, or most people, like billions of people have access to it in the world. Of course, they still have other challenges, but the distribution is where most startups, businesses, founders fail, because just as you said, that's where the value capture is happening, in the movie industry or the content distribution or pretty much e-commerce or wherever you go in whichever industry. And that's what a lot of influencers and content creators have realized, that, hey, we've got the distribution, we can control. So that's why they are no longer, a lot of them, the bigger ones, are no longer working with other brands. They are launching their own brands, I'm sure you might be aware of, like KSI's Prime or lots, or Gary Vee has launched multiple wines and stuff or brands, and then sold them within a few months for $100 million or something like that, because they've realized, oh, we've got the distribution, we've got the 6 million followers or 5 million or whatever the number might be. But as long as you've got distribution, you don't need to worry about anything else. So I think you guys are focusing on the right thing, that is distribution. And if any founders listening, go and figure out distribution before you start building your mission and vision and everything and building a team.
Yeah, it's so true. In movies, it's actually even more obvious, and a lot of people miss this. It's so important to work from the end backwards. So I'll give you an example. Yes. Let's say that you are a filmmaker, you want to make a movie, and you find a story that you're really excited about, passionate about, you just really believe in it. You come to me and you say, hey, I have this story, it's unbelievable. I have these people involved. These are really talented, exciting, maybe even celebrity people. And the first question that an investor should be asking is, do you have distribution? And I remember when people used to ask that for me, and I'd be like, well, if I had distribution, why would I be talking to you? Because like literally, usually the distributor would be my financier. But that's actually the wrong mentality, because what you can do is you can actually find distribution before you make the project, before you invest any money. And what will happen is you can find people who say, wow, that sounds really exciting. If you have this actor, if you have this director, if you have this story, if you complete it, we'll give you, let's say, $100,000 to release it in this country. And you could go territory by territory, and you could literally raise millions of dollars even of people who say, if you complete this project, we will literally pay you this much money. And then you can go to an investor and say, I have all these contracts of all these people who are going to pay me when I deliver. Now you can give me your money, and then I'm going to go deliver. And we know that there's these people who are going to buy the product when it's completed. And that's a really safe bet for an investor, because they can go, okay, there's a chance that they don't complete. There's a chance that these people don't perform when we deliver. But at least we know that there's a market, there's interest, there's people who are excited, and someone has gone out and established the legitimacy, the existence of that market in advance of asking for my money. Now, what most people do is they say, I have this great idea, and they get the money and they start spending the money, and they go, okay, how are we going to find, we need to find a market. And they run out of money before they find the market, or they realize they never had a product market fit in the first place. Yes. And so that's why a lot of products and movies and startups fail, is because they just can't find the market.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. You said it. I do love the decent work in this space. Last 2 years, I've been working predominantly in the Web3 space. We invest in Web3 companies, we advise and help them grow and stuff. But I know that decentralization also has a lot of issues. Otherwise, it would be adopted everywhere. Everyone would be using a decentralized everything. In your point of view, what are some of the key problems you have seen when going down the whole decentralized path?
That's such a good question. It's something I really think a lot about. I spent a lot of time thinking about decentralization. And I also realized that, I'm not going to say a number, but the strong majority, like probably close to everything out there, is not decentralized. And even if they talk about it being decentralized, or they have a vision of decentralization, fundamentally, if you've raised money into a company, have a bank account, you're not decentralized. These are all, so the implicitly, the Web3 industry is challenged with, fundamentally, they have this vision, collective vision for decentralization. But logistically, if you need money and you need team members, then you most likely have equity. And if you have equity, you have centralization. If you have a bank account, someone had to put a passport or their social security or something of that nature up for that, for KYC, AML. And so so that money is ultimately tied to an individual. That's centralized, right? So how can you build truly decentralized systems? And we see a lot of flaws that can be detrimental when there's a mistake made. If a smart contract has a vulnerability, and you see all these hacks. And by the way, we see hacks both in things that are purported to be decentralized and centralized. Yes. They've struggled. We just watched MGM get taken to their knees.
It happens all the time. How many times has PlayStation had hacks? PlayStation Network, all the logins and everything stolen and data stolen. My health insurance had a hack, and my phone number is out there. And so since that hack, I'm getting spam calls and messages all the time. And I've got like a 20-year-old phone number I don't want to change. So it happens.
So it's tragic. Yeah. It's part of the tragedy, right? So good code can still be exploited, and getting to excellent code is very difficult, because you have to go through the path of determining if there's vulnerabilities, and really the test of time is the only thing that you really know if there's some legitimacy to that. But back to your question on what are the challenges, if you could say, about centralization, or and also what are the opportunities around around decentralization. What are some of the challenges around decentralization, and what are some of the opportunities around it? So I think that one of the biggest challenges when we talk about decentralization, true decentralization, and this is where a lot of the fear comes into the Web3 world around decentralization is around like criminality and people doing nefarious things utilizing these decentralized networks. So the lack of ability to police them and really potentially funding terrorism and things like that, like this. So I think that it's important to delineate between anonymous decentralized networks and yes. networks that don't focus on anonymity. And I think that in the beginning of, for instance, Bitcoin, you're looking at a Bitcoin address and money moving across the network and people, there was a sense of anonymity there where it's like, hey, I can send money to you and no one will know that we did that transaction. We've realized now that doesn't really exist anymore.
It's the opposite of it. It's more transparent right. than the traditional. Right. You can look at right. anyone's wallet address and then see all the transactions they have done. You can't totally. Do that you can't look at someone's bank account number and see all the transactions they have done. So it's completely opposite of that. It's in fact transparent. So blockchain is transparent, it's permissionless, and it's decentralized. So
totally.
But continue.
And so one of the things that, we were struggling with in very early on talking about building a decentralized network was in the wake of major projects. If you think back to Kim.com and Mega Upload.
He lives here. He lives 10 miles away from my home. Like his mansion was, because I live in New Zealand. So was very big here, very big case here. Mega. I don't know if you remember Mega.com and all that. And
So if people don't know what we're talking about, you should definitely Google it because someone should make a movie about that.
Yes.
It's a crazy story. And really it harks back to the Napster, LimeWire, Mega, which was around file sharing. And what was happening is you had these storage really around centralized storage. They figured, hey, we're outside of, the US, so we're outside of its laws and just transmitting files. And what people started doing is transmitting movies and music, copyrighted material. And it was deemed that because that content was hosted on this Kim.com's centralized servers and wherever he was, that ultimately he had committed these crimes of aiding and abetting this piracy. And so that was just obviously very unfortunate, but it was learning the hard lesson, right? Of the importance of copyright, sovereignty, and intellectual property rights being like an important thing. When we were focused on how to build a network, that was the big thing was like, I don't want to have servers that could potentially have anything inappropriate on them because people are crazy. People can do stuff that could, put you at risk.
Yeah, that's guaranteed. It's internet or like it's decentralized. Yeah.
But here's the cool thing about this network in particular. So it uses, this will get a little bit technologically orientated for
go
a
ahead,
moment.
Go ahead, because a lot of
it uses a technology called CJDNS. And what CJDNS is a peer-to-peer mesh networking technology. And what that means is that, I'll give you an example. Let's say I have an internet connection and a computer, and I'm running CJDNS on my computer. And you have a computer and you're running CJDNS, but you don't have an internet connection. Now, we could end up connecting peer-to-peer, meaning I can connect to your computer. It could be through an antenna. It could be even through Wi-Fi or even Bluetooth. And at that point, I'm now mesh networked into your internet connection, even though I don't have a direct internet connection from an ISP. Like I'm able to get to the internet through you. With that said, it uses a VPN technology as the tunnel between us. So just because we're connected doesn't mean you've given me open access to your entire network and to your computer. And that's the risk, right? Is if I connect to you, boom, now I have access to everything you have access to. But using CJDNS, it actually builds a decentralized network peer-to-peer where people can get internet access without directly having an internet connection. So I thought that was really fascinating and that got me really excited. And that becomes the backbone to what's now become the Packet network. So PKT, its network is basically operated CJDNS, at the root of CJDNS. And actually just on the side, CJDNS was just incorporated into Bitcoin Core. And the reason was so that Bitcoin miners can ensure that they can get blocks to the internet, even in a peer-to-peer situation. So it's definitely revered as really an important technology, but it hasn't really proliferated in a very big way. And that's the vision behind the Packet project was really, how do we get CJDNS out onto more computers and economically incentivize people to participate in the CJDNS project? That's ultimately the core vision behind Packet. But here's the cool part. The next piece, now that you have a network, is what do you do with this network? And so what CJ DNS does allow you to do is build a website that can exist within that network. So now you have a network peer-to-peer. Yeah. That's decentralized. Anyone can start up a node. You don't even need to have an internet connection, a direct internet connection to participate in the network. If you can connect to another peer, you can set up a website and that website exists within that network. And here's where it gets amazing. The web URL is your IPv6 address. So literally you can then have your website hosted inside of the network and your IPv6 address is the URL of your website. So it means I can make a website. It has my IPv6 address and you can then access that and the network. And this is where it gets even more amazing. So how do you do payments? How do you do the integrated payments? What the development team has created is the ability for your IPv6 address to actually be your payment address. So I can actually send you money using the web URL of your website. And that's just an incredibly powerful thing because you've now compressed the entire stack of having a website, which is payment processing, being able to have essentially DNS and being able to domicile that website and have network access all into one stack of code. And so we find that really empowering, really exciting. It's still super early days.
It is super early, but it is super exciting. Pretty much you're building another internet.
Yeah, but it's directly connected to the main internet. So it's not like you have to say, hey, come use this separate internet. You can still get access to it straight over Google. But here's the cool thing from a decentralized standpoint, anybody can do anything on that network. So your first reaction is, what if people do really messed up stuff? What if people do illegal stuff on that network? But here's the crazy part. Your web URL is your IPv6 address, which means that your IPv6 address identifies your location. So to do something illegal by also publicizing your location would be actually maybe the definition of insanity, right? So it's usually you're doing something illegal. You're trying to do it in the dark. You don't want anyone to know that you're doing it. But if you're advertising your IPv6 address while you're doing something illegal, then you're just telling anybody who did want to police that network exactly where you are. So it becomes somewhat of a self-policing network where you just like wouldn't really want to use that network to do illegal stuff per se. So we find that is a potential mitigant to what you could say the bigger risks of decentralization. And that's the fact that it's not an anonymity tool. It's not a place that you would go to hide out and do things potentially nefarious or illegal. It's really just meant to be a tool to empower growth, access to distribution, fluidity of payments, and transparency.
Oh, that's fantastic. I really like what you guys are building. I have a contrarian view to the whole decentralization debate. And my view is people might say they care about like security and safety and stuff, but in reality, they don't. The thing that they care more about than that is customer service. It's like we would stay just how Airbnb found it super challenging to get their first round of funding is because when you hear the first pitch back in the days when they were not well known, they weren't big. It's what you want me to go and sleep in a stranger's attic. I'm going to get murdered. It's crazy. Who would do that? But now it's accepted because it is convenient. They have made it easy to do that. And most of the decentralization does not have customer service. They don't have, whereas Airbnb did have, and even now, how they do is I have made a wrong booking and I was just 3 months ago in Canada. I made a wrong booking or something happened and the host couldn't. And then I contacted them and they immediately refunded me fully and helped me with my, and within 2 minutes, they pick up the phone. I didn't have to go from person to person. I cannot have that experience in a decentralized places, early days of Bitcoin, you're sending, or even now from a DeFi wallet to another DeFi wallet, Bitcoin, you send $200,000 or even $20 worth of Bitcoin and it's gone to the wrong number, wrong address. That's it. We are going to There is no customer service. If you have customer service, if you tell someone that, hey, your, what do you call your burger is going to be
lost your money.
Yeah. Yeah. But like in the opposite example is like Uber Eats, you're going to sell someone that, hey, your burger is going to be delivered by a crazy person, but people will still go because it's so easy. You don't know what your taxi driver is like, but you, your Uber driver is, but you go.
I agree with you. And so I agree with you 100%.
Care about convenience more than security. Most people don't care about, or that's so not even an afterthought for most people, 99%. We would be an exception who are going in these theoretical discussions. People don't want the mental load of having to worry about a smart contract, getting it audited, all that stuff. They can't be bothered. It's like it's a convenient. So I know people who work in tech who have said to me, I'm quite high up in the Web2 world, that they trust their bank more than they trust themselves, because they don't trust themselves to remember and keep a
their password
somewhere safe, their 12-fraud trace key somewhere safe, and they're going to lose it. But bank, they can call the customer service and recover it. So that is the biggest problem with decentralization or biggest challenge that people had to come across.
It's such a good point. Let me just say one thing about that, though.
Yes.
What I think is that you have decentralized tools that provide rails for people to innovate on, right? And the internet is literally the perfect example of this. The internet is fully decentralized, and look at what has been fostered on top of the internet, right? If we go back to the beginning of the internet, the days of DARPA, it was literally just like connecting over phone lines. There was nothing there. And then bring in the search capabilities and then the website capabilities. And that was all decentralized, how that all began. And it's become more and more structured over time. And really, decentralization, the core decentralization of the internet, is what fostered a lot of these centralized Fortune 500 companies and systems that have all been built upon that decentralized infrastructure. So I think we have to delineate between true decentralization, as far as what you're talking about, products, services, where you're right, most people want to have a customer service agent who's going to help them with this particular product or service, and then a decentralized infrastructure where centralized companies, entrepreneurs, businesses can utilize those resources to build new and innovative enterprises, products, and solutions that can be centralized. So I don't think there's an innate problem with centralization. In fact, we've seen that's actually important, and humanity actually relies on centralization in so many different ways and predominantly relies on it. But decentralized tools, if they are fundamentally innovative, if they can bring real benefit, then the idea, even if we talk about the network that I've been discussing here, that network should bring new centralized services, businesses, entrepreneurship should be utilizing that network as a tool for them to build centralized products and services, offerings, companies, whatever, on top of that network.
Oh, that's fantastic. I completely understand that. Yeah, I do think that decentralization should build the rails for the next layer of innovation. And I do believe that when a technology gets adopted, when it goes invisible. So most people connect to internet, they don't know. 99% of people in the world would not know what is IPv6 and DNS and what's your DNS. They don't know. They don't need to care.
They shouldn't care.
So it's like when it gets invisible, it gets adopted. While it is still able to jump through hoops, like what we do in Web3, it's not going to get it. The only reason people are in it is so they can flip something from lower price to higher price. That's what they're in for.
I agree.
And so my next question is on Routy.io. Mm-hmm. And how does the economics of it work? How does the model work?
Great question. Yeah, we definitely want to talk about this. So the way that the Routy product works is essentially a Wi-Fi solution for businesses, hospitality businesses in particular, offering guest Wi-Fi. So the economics are actually quite simple. We charge a monthly fee for our customer to be able to use these services. And what those services consist of is a business setting up guest Wi-Fi so that when their customers come into the business and access the internet, they can do that without requiring a password. They're simply just entering in their email address to get access. Nice. And the customer entering into that email access is then placed into a customer database, and that gives the business a touch point with their actual customer. And you can see the footfall data, how often that individual came into the business, how much time they've spent on the internet. There's a lot of data that's being built at the business level for them to have a relationship with their customer. You can understand the time of day that they're coming in. If they came in during a certain promotional period, let's say it was like a Father's Day, but you can know, hey, that person came in here on Father's Day, so next Father's Day, we can invite them back. And it's really to help empower businesses to communicate more specifically with their customers. And I think knowing and having been a business owner so many different times in my life, having a close relationship with the hospitality industry and understanding really one of the biggest challenges is getting people into your business. That's just obviously what you're trying to do. And how do you do that when you don't know who your customer is. Yes, they come in, they swipe a credit card, they've been in your restaurant in the last 30 days or the last month, but how do you communicate with that person for them to come back? It's actually very, there's only a few real ways for that to happen, even if they are following you in social media. If you don't have their email address or their SMS, if you don't know who they are, what their name is, what their nationality is, any of this data, then how can you effectively communicate with that customer? How can you build customer loyalty? So really the product is
focused on social media. Does not matter. Less than 10% of people will be shown your social media, organic social media post because they want to optimize it to charge you to run ads and stuff. So Facebook is not going to show your post to everyone who follows your page, and vice same thing with Instagram or any social media platform.
Or LinkedIn or anything. So what's happening is we're in a phase as social media users where you're just thinking, hey, I just have to pound my audience with marketing and just hope that a percentage of those people will convert into visits. We have to do word of mouth campaigns. We have to do various different grassroots campaigns. But a lot of that's just, it's just so nebulous how you're going to get that customer to come into your business or have a repeat customer come back to your business. And so this is really just focusing on giving tools to business owners so that they can become more data driven and build a more specific relationship with their customer and really focusing on customer loyalty. So those are the core pieces. And the fun part for us, because that's, it's pretty basic. And it's also, I think what we could say is we're not inventing the wheel here. There are other tools out there, but there's some very specific parts of our product that are very unique. And one of the things that besides offering an extremely low entry point for pricing and making this technology available to specifically small businesses who might not be able to afford to get this type of technology into their business, because it's, you know, hundreds, many hundreds of dollars for the hardware. Oftentimes companies are charging licensing fees, very hefty subscription fees. And a lot of the tech that I've seen from our competitors is pretty low level, poor UI, or just not a great user experience. So we've really focused on user experience and giving our customers, the people using this product, a very inexpensive entry point and then just great technology so that they can have as much data, as much information to really make great decisions for their business and their marketing.
Oh, fantastic. No, that's really good. That makes so much sense. I have just two more questions before I finish. And first one is, what is your biggest challenge currently at Rowty.io?
Yeah, so our biggest challenge for sure is, I'd say our biggest challenge is getting prospects over the hump into a purchase. That's always going to be our biggest challenge because we're not selling a software that you can just download off the internet and it's a one-time fee. It's a much easier thing to sell in that way because it's actually involving them taking some action at their business. So there's some hand-holding and we offer great customer service and our sales team has been really, this is actually a cool piece about our business is that how we're prospecting, how we're building really close relationships with our customers and giving them confidence and a real close relationship with our sales team so that they know, hey, we're here for you. We're not just trying to sell you something. Yeah. We're literally going to be part of your journey to optimizing your marketing and helping you drive your business revenue. And that relationship is actually turning a lot of our customers into ambassadors. Like they're excited about the product. They're excited about the company. They're excited about what it's doing for their business. And then they want to become ambassadors to help communicate it to other business owners that you should be doing this as well. So that's one of the big challenges. The other big challenge that we realized, and this is, I think, new, and a lot of business owners should listen to this advice here. There is a misconception that when you're trying to sell a product, that you should market the product. And again, I'm just going to say it again. There's a misconception that when you're trying to sell a product, that you should be marketing the product, meaning, hey, here's my product, you should buy it. Or here's my product, here's all the features that this product does. The problem with that is that when people are seeing that type of advertising or that type of marketing, you become a bit desensitized to it. You feel bombarded or you don't want to see it multiple times. I'm not really inclined to like a Facebook page or an Instagram profile if all they're going to do is just show me ads for their products. And so what we've been seeing is this new type of marketing where you're seeing social media accounts that are offering value, that's offering value to their followers that's secondary to their product actually providing that solution. So I'll give you an example. We're trying to sell a guest Wi-Fi product. But what we're doing in our marketing is we're offering you all these different tips and tricks to improve the revenue of and your relationship with your customer. So now you're more inclined to follow our social media account because you're actually learning something about your business and how to help your business without me just trying to sell you, hard sell you my product.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, you say that. I was just going to say that sell the benefit, not the feature, but this is taking it another step forward, and that is provide value upfront and build a relationship first before you even sell or before you even talk about your features and things like that.
Totally. Yeah. So an example is you could say like here in your marketing, here's five tips that can help you increase the revenue of your business. If I'm a business owner, I'm going to listen to that. If one of those is guest Wi-Fi, I'm going to be like, oh, guest Wi-Fi, interesting. And then when you say you should look at Rowdy's product as your guest Wi-Fi solution, I'm like, okay, I'm going to look into that because that's one of five pieces of information that this social media profile gave me that I need to understand. And I can continue as a business to offer value to our customers over time or prospective customers, people who have never bought from us. And there could be a huge amount of people who will never buy for us, but could end up sharing that post and saying, hey, here's 10 things you should do for your business. Someone else could see it and could become a prospective customer. Whereas like very few people are going to share my ad. That's not really going to be something I get shared.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so, so true. My last question is, and that is that, what is your ask? Pretty much you have shared in a way with your challenge anyway, but do you have any other ask? Are you looking for funding? Are you looking to hire or anything else? Feel free to share.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would say our biggest ask right now is we're looking for customers. That's my biggest ask, is looking for people who this product can really help support. Yeah, we were very fortunate to raise a round of capital last year, and that's positioned the business to take us to where we are today. We've been able to really put heads down in building tech. And now we're focused on building relationships with business owners, hotels, and even small businesses that don't have the money to invest in some of these big name products that could cost tens of thousands or more for install. This is like small business owners who want to take advantage of how technology can support their business. So I'd say the biggest ask is if there's anybody out there watching this that finds any interest in guest Wi-Fi and thinks that it could benefit their business or a friend or family member's business, we'd love to talk to them.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much, Jesse. What I'll do is I'll leave a link underneath in the description to Rowdy and to all your social media profiles so people can reach out to you. People can find out more about how it can benefit their business, if they're running a cafe or any hospitality business, how they can connect with their customer and deliver more value and encourage that repeat business from their customers. So I think that's like a very clear value proposition that Rowdy can do for their business.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah, it was wonderful chatting with you. Thanks for all your wonderful questions. And this is great. Hopefully we can do it again.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I'm going to interview someone from your technical team to understand how it works on the technical side of things so that people, the other founders, when they're building solutions, they can keep a product like this in mind and build solutions on top of that. Because one of the other things you said is that decentralization can build the rails for a fairer internet. And I think which is what we all want. So it'd be great for them to learn as well from that. So yeah, definitely we should do this again. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. I'll just say this in closing. The Rowdy technology is all utilizing the packet network. So while packet network and cryptocurrency, none of that comes into our marketing, the reality is that the privacy elements, the VPN of the Rowdy business is all utilizing that decentralized network. So it's a perfect example of how a decentralized network provides the rails for a centralized business.
Oh, that's fantastic. On that note, thank you so once again for your time and wish you best of luck for building Rowdy and Packet Network.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you so much for tuning in and listening or watching this episode of the Web3 with Sam Kamani podcast. By now, you know the drill. Leave a comment or share this episode with a friend and leave a review. I would love to hear from you. So that's why my DMs are open. Reach out to me, especially if you are a founder building a product in Web3. Then I would love to hear from you. What are your challenges? Is there anything that I can help you or my community can help you with? Thank you once again and wish you best of luck in building your startup or your project.